Hello, everybody. This is Calm Sword, and I'd like to welcome you to a brand new season of podcast. We were on a little bit of an hiatus, as I'll get into in just a moment, but it's just great to be back. We've got some new equipment, some new team members. The Discord community that we're based out of, Tau 40,000, has grown exponentially. We have hundreds of new members. It's really great to see everything growing. I don't want to give too much away about what's going to come up, but as always, we are constantly taking recommendations for new episodes, and in this season we'll be expanding to incorporate things other than the Tau. This episode is going to be dedicated to the speculative knowledge of the new Leagues of Votan that have been hinted at on the Warhammer community website, and their kind of loose connections that they have with the Demiurge. Again, as I'll get into it in just a moment, we've kind of hit this interesting point where we're just we don't have too much left to go on when it comes to the Tau on the official level. So let's think of season three as the birth of hypothesis, as well as talking about some of the more the broader natures of this this galaxy we all have our hobby living in. Let's jump in. Where to begin? I haven't done an episode, a new episode, in about 8 weeks, 2 months. Just a kind of a quick refresh on that. I was coming off of a particularly complicated and time-consuming job in the real world, and then all of this stuff in Eastern Europe has been going on, and I have some friends, some very longtime friends who are over there. One of which is now a medic in the Ukrainian defense forces. So it's interesting because my hobby is Warhammer 40,000, and I spend a lot of time both in my community and trying to make events happen, and then I really enjoy lore writing. So I do a lot of stuff, a lot of fan fiction stuff, particularly with Cold Open, which if you haven't ever heard of them, I would check them out. I think they're probably the most complex fan audio. I don't know what you call them anymore, but like audio performance, audio dramas. They're fantastic. They're run by a guy named Colin. He's really cool. He's out of Canada. So I really recommend them. But I spend a lot of time with Warhammer 40,000. I very much take it probably too seriously in terms of just like trying to understand the lore, which is always kind of complicated, because at any point in time there can be a retcon, as there was about 4 or 5 years ago, with the timelines shifting, and it's a complicated hobby. But it's something that's very important to me. And when the stuff in Ukraine was going on, and my friend was talking about going over and then left, I felt a little bit guilty. Spending as much time as I do on let's call it make believe war, when people around me were experiencing actual war. So a combination of professional life and personal life kind of kept me away from wanting to spend the amount of time it takes to make one of these these podcasts. But as is often the case, over time, you start missing the things. And I have felt as though kind of owe it to the community a little bit in order to have some consistency. The podcast has more and more subscribers. A lot of them make donations. Nothing crazy, but even just a dollar for a fan podcast is like more than I ever expected. And so there's a little bit of obligation that I feel, and I think that 2 months was a good amount of time to give myself the, you know, a cool down from from season two. Season two ended with the release of the Codex. It was fantastic. We had a really good session where we people in the community sat down and we cracked it open. Redrix was co-host, and I think that it was a great place to conclude. We're now 20 episodes in, 35 hours of content, I think that, you know, let's kick off with season three. But I start off with a complication, and that is, there's been an enormous amount of miniatures and rule, I don't know what you want to call it, FAQs being FAQ'd. There's been the celebrities of our hobby, you know, who play, you know, dare I say, play professionally, have had a lot of input on the enormous nerfs that have gone left and right, but then also coupled with the buffs. It's a complicated time. But what does that mean for lore? And I guess something to, you know, I'm in it for the lore. I spend a lot of time trying to decipher things, but eventually, you know, especially with the Xenos faction that we all seem to probably enjoy. I know that there's some Space Marine people that listen, and every now and again I'll get a pretty salty comment about the interactions between Tau and Space Marines, but generally speaking, you know, we all love Tau, and there has not been that much lore. Each of the codexes is a little bit slimmer than they used to be. There used to be kind of a lot of rich deciphering of flavor text and timeline speculations and things like that. And the new codexes kind of don't have that. I was under the impression that this was going to lead to a more robust Black Library support or Warhammer Plus with their own lore masters. Let me tell you, I was so scared of lore masters originally because it was like, you know, you're kind of hearing it from the horse's mouth, and any speculation, and speculation is rich in our community, would have just been silenced. But it's the Lore Master channel on Warhammer Plus, if you haven't seen it, is very it's very tame. Not too much speculation, more of like reporting. It's a little bit like a report on whatever content is in a codex or a white dwarf or things like that. So speculation can continue. But in terms of like books, we haven't, you know, the Tau haven't gotten really any books. The Eldar haven't gotten really any books. The 30K, even 30K is kind of slowed down. So a couple people, you know, obviously speculate that this is the sign that 10th edition is coming, and that there will be an upheaval of lore in the same way that 8th edition, well, I guess 8th kind of 9th edition, had an upheaval of lore. But what does that leave for a lore podcast like this one to talk about? You know, eventually we do get to the end of the rainbow, you know, and at the end of that rainbow, what, you know, I can add my own speculations as to the inner workings of the Ethereal High Council, as much as we can talk about the induction fields of a pulse rifle and its effects versus a bolter. But eventually we're kind of going in circles a little bit. And so what season three of podcast is going to be, a slight departure away from the more well-beaten path of Tau lore. And now I've talked about this a couple times before. Back in the day, you know, in the misty, long-toothed past, There was a time where Games Workshop was just a very different company. There were a lot of, let me put it this way. It's very difficult for people, I think, to conceptualize becoming a mover and a shaker in like the Star Wars universe, right? Like Star Wars, it's owned by Disney. It's a monolithic franchise. People like J.J. Abrams is at the helm. Favreau and all of these things. It's very like you look at Star Wars, and for me at least, it's difficult to see myself ever going back to the old expanded universe and being like, hey, remember Mara Jade? And you kind of get in that community. It's more like there's a structured release of what is and what will be, both on their many shows, I guess not movies anymore, but like their audiobooks and books. Like it's very segmented. And Warhammer kind of feels like that, I think, these days, where we hear about them in the regular news. I mean, I think the guy that started Games Workshop just got knighted a couple of weeks ago. And it started to kind of feel like that. Hey, let's call it the Disney treatment or the Apple treatment. Like you there it's hard to see where you could really have an effect on the lore, because there's a little bit of a leash. Well, no, it's not a little bit. There's definitely a leash. But back way back, and I'm talking like, oh man, I'm talking like 20 years ago. 20 years ago, if I remember correctly, Games Workshop was run by people very much like you and me. The writer staff were not just science fiction writers, but they were everyday Joes, and they really helmed the process of telling stories in the Warhammer 40,000 setting. And a lot of people, recently. A lot of people. No. People I have headbutted and encountered on Reddit. One of the very strong things that happens is that, especially these days, is that there is no story to Warhammer 40,000. That's the new kind of banner that I see being raised a lot in conversation, especially when there's lore discrepancies. And that is that Warhammer 40,000 is a setting, and that the story is irrelevant. That may be the case. I may be aging out of I may be aging out of where the community is going. I don't know. But being that I recall a time where the narrative was all important, that's just where I'm comfortable. And so 20 years ago, regular people were basically coming together and becoming these incredible authors that we know today, Aaron Dembski, Bowden, Graham McNeil. Really the biggest name was Dan Abnett. But Dan Abnett, he wasn't it's not like he created Black Library. He was an author, and he came over from Marvel Studios, I believe. Yeah. And or before Marvel Studios, excuse me, just plain old Marvel. And they crafted this universe that was that is the grim dark satire story, they invented new races. They brought it out of the middling early 90s, where it was really just kind of where it was hard satire. And in doing so, they made something extremely unique, in which kind of there was enough room for all of these stories to happen. But most importantly, they had interaction with the community. Black Library used to have a forum that you could talk directly to these people. And sometimes, I'll be in conversations with people on the Discord, Reddit, whatever. I feel like I'll say something that is, very recently, for example, I brought up the fact that I recall engaging directly with Andy Hoare, who I placed the creator of the Tau title at his feet. Or Graham McNeil. And I'll bring up like, oh, well, this was said at X time. And someone will say like, oh, well, screen grab, like show me that that's true. And it's interesting because I don't have screen grabs, because this is just 50 15, 18, 20 years ago, when you could just reach out to these people. And that's kind of indicative of, I think, where the hobby is right now. Is there's seemingly this wall, you know? If an author comes out and says, like, I think a couple people might have seen it when Aaron Dembski Bowden came out and was like, you know, why aren't there female custodies? And that's an incendiary conversation because of the, you know, the Space Marine female question. And it shouldn't be. It's kind of a silly topic in general. But like, but he brought it up and was, you know, he's extremely well versed in the lore because he invented most of it, if not directly, then indirectly through talking with the other Black Library authors. And you know, and there was this kind of a shutdown that happened on Twitter, and now we just don't have that. Now there's kind of silence, and maybe it could also be because of the whole Matt Ward incident, when Matt Ward re-envisioned, I think it was a combination of Ultramarines, but definitely Grey Knights, and the community just had this kind of over the top reaction, kind of middling internet. I don't know what it would be like these days, but you know, the rumor is he got death threats. And now there's this wall that exists between the creators and I guess we're all consumers. So, but back in the day, you were able to, there was no wall, and you could just go back and forth, and you could ask somebody straight up why they made this decision in the storytelling and why they believe something is true or not true. And so it's hard to see, at least I'll speak for myself, it's hard to see me ever having a direct impact on the greater 40K narrative. And maybe, you know, maybe regular people don't deserve to these days. Maybe it has to be the way that it is. But I do, obviously I do miss it. But that's kind of what brings us to the topic at hand today. Because we're about to get a new species. Well, a new faction. Let's call it a new faction. A new faction is coming out for Warhammer 40,000. It's the first time in a while. You know, the last big faction was Gene Stealer Cults. That was probably the biggest addition. Custodes, for sure. And I know many of you play Custodes, so I don't want to walk through that minefield. But I don't think that the Custodes really constitute as a full faction. If anything, I kind of think that they're almost an elite choice, but that's neither here nor there. And obviously I don't want to be burned down for thinking that, but you know, Gene Stealer Cults represent kind of like a completely different take on the 40K universe. You know, they're human. They're obviously being mutated by the Gene Stealer's Kiss. We've talked about them in a previous episode. I really love the Gene Stealer Cults. I especially like the idea that, you know, because they are inherently human and humans are built with all of these flaws, they are humans that do not have any of the kind of the lingering doubts I guess I'll just speak for myself, that I would have, right? Like I don't question existence. I do question existence. I question, you know, what happens after we die, what is immortality, things like that. A Gene Stealer Cultist doesn't worry about this because they have the presence of their God in their minds all the time. And so I find that fascinating, especially then when you couple it with the fact that this strength eventually turns into horror when the Tyranids finally do arrive and chomp down on your whole society. Like I said, I love the Gene Stealer Cults. But now we're getting a really interesting faction, in that they're not entirely unique. They are called the Leagues of Votan. And it looks like, well, it's all but confirmed that this is kind of either the reimagining or the rebranding of the Squats. Now, the Squats actually take place far before my time. For those of you who might not know, the Squats, Warhammer 40,000 was very much a reflection of Warhammer Fantasy, which in turn is a kind of a strange reflection of Lord of the Rings and high fantasy Dungeons and Dragons. But But Warhammer 40,000, I mean, we have space elves in the form of Eldar. We have space orcs. I don't know what they're called. I guess, I don't know if we've changed the name of orcs to Orruk or something like that. Maybe that's just Age of Sigmar. But an orc is an orc, an Eldar is an elf. I guess humans are human. But there used to be this race called Squats, which were just dwarves. Like all the way from the like iconography of these sigils that you usually see orcs, or excuse me, dwarves have, like somewhere between like the, you know, like Northern Scottish kind of stereotype meets like Nordic runes and whatnot. But they were dwarves. And Warhammer 40,000, I guess in the mid 90s, late 90s, kind of went into a rebranding very similar to what we all went through like 4 or 5 years ago, where there's going to be, you know, we're going to, in back then it was, we're going to make this way more metal. And if you want to see an example of that, just look at the Black Templars battle box that was released with this insane artwork of just, you know, their skulls and the sky is burning, and you know they look, it's just way more metal, and they dialed 40K entirely to like a hard R rating, and that's where you get in my opinion some of the most intense storytelling. Storm of Iron by Graham McNeil is one of my first Warhammer 40K books. I would highly recommend it because it really captures like what Grimdark is. Probably too niche, you know. Probably if I tried to convince someone from one of the other franchises to take a look, they'd be like, you know, why on earth would you like a universe like this? There, people are cannibalizing each other, and you know, there's there's an uncaring god emperor that needs to be fed 1,000 souls a day. You know, all of that stuff was basically invented back then. But the so as a result, the squats were kind of jettisoned. A lot of people say it was because they weren't a high selling army. I'm going to be honest, from the perspective, especially from the perspective of an early gamer back in the late 90s, early 2000s, it doesn't, a lot of decisions were not made for the purposes of sale. It's a company makes money, things like that. But the like post-capitalist perspective of like everything needs to have a dollar amount just didn't exist, especially at Games Workshop. The people that were running it were making a game, telling a story. The massive desire for ultimate wealth just wasn't in every decision. I could be corrected, but like I just came back from a con, one of the first since we've reopened, and I got a chance to talk to a lot of the kind of the old school tabletop gamers. I'm not going to use their names here, but like, but I got to talk to a lot of them, especially kind of integral people that were involved with Dungeons and Dragons. And just back in the day, there was just a lot more cross-pollination between companies and staff. And like, it wasn't so much about the money. I mean, everybody needs to work, but like a lot of decisions were made because of taste. And quite frankly, I mean, like every grandpa that exists, I'm going to say that I do wish we had a little bit more of that. But anyway, the squats were let go. And the squats were very much like the early orcs, where the orcs were kind of like the comic relief and, you know, words like soccer hooligan get thrown around. They were let go of because they were effectively, you know, alcoholic, diminutive abhumans, and it just didn't fit in this metal hardcore version of 40K. But now they're coming back, seemingly. Obviously, nobody's used the word squat, at least on an official basis. They are called the Leagues of Votan. The Leagues of Votan are interesting because in what we've seen so far, especially the lore that was recently released, is that it looks like they are Dark Age of Technology human divergent mutants. Now back in the day, there were way more types of mutants. We had, you know, we have beastmen, we had cat people, dog people, dwarves.
everything that you kind of get used to seeing in like a fantasy element, 40K had in the form of abhumans. Ogrinds are just ogres. Ratlings are hobbits. And from the perspective of the Imperium, which is this, you know, supremely xenophobic, but also, they're kind of racial purists. There are sanctioned or let's kind of use the term excused divergences, which vary from world to world, sector to sector. But generally speaking, if you are like short because of some kind of mutation, or tall and massive, there's like a level of acceptance. However, generally speaking, like in the case of the Ogrins, they're more or less a slave population. And for the squats, which I'll get a little bit into, the squats were unique in that they were actually a society of humans that had universally, I mean, they basically altered their evolutionary track to be able to operate on the higher gravity worlds of the galactic core. Interesting to think that the galactic core might have, you know, kind of broadly more high gravity worlds on it. I always thought that was kind of cool. Which, of course, would make me think that if you live on the fringe of the galaxy, do you have less gravity? You know, are there super tall, thin, emaciated humans somewhere? And the answer, of course, is probably. But in the case of the squats, not only had they changed their evolutionary tract to be these compact, you know, literally squat human beings, but they had retained a lot of the Dark Age of Technology abilities. I say abilities because it goes beyond STC. STC, everybody should know, is kind of like the gold standard. It varies as to what exactly an STC is, but effectively it's a blueprint or a codex of blueprints that allow you to make devices as complex as a teleportarium to a combat knife, except whatever it is going to tell you how to build it, it's going to be 10 times, 15 times better than anything you can possibly imagine. And it's the reason for a lot of treasure hunts and full-on wars. You know, Adeptus Mechanicus Explorator fleets have gone to war against other Space Marine factions to try to recover STC technology. It's a big deal. But the squats basically did not have that. And the reason for the scarcity of these things is because of the Age of Strife. And the Age of Strife comes out of this, humanity has their own version of the War in Heaven, in which Iron Men, or Men of Iron, Stone Men, and Gold Men were originally kind of pitted against. But with the Men of Iron being these artificial, intelligent, these AI, I don't know what to call them, like super creations. They could do basically anything. And what little we do know about them is they had weapons that kind of rival a lot of the descriptions that Necron technology has. So like sentient black holes and like the ability to change time. There's a really fantastic excerpt from the Emperor of Mankind book from 40K where there's implications that like we might not actually be in like the timeline of 40,000 AD, and that the war between the Men of Iron and the Men of Gold, which the Men of Stone were then kind of caught in the middle of, might have actually changed time itself. And we are on a divergent, like in when you look at Warhammer 40K, that is not our future. That is a possible future because they departed for whatever reason. Again, could probably go on for days when it comes to this stuff. But needless to say, humanity, this kind of burgeoning early empire that kind of competed a little bit with the Eldar, it collapses in on itself. After this gigantic war, artificial intelligence is outlawed. Clearly, the Men of Gold, or at least humanity, wins in that aspect since it continues. But the squats basically weather the storm, and then the resulting descent into the Dark Ages, where planets and many empires break apart from this original human endeavor and devolve into everything that kind of we see what the Emperor is then facing in 30K. But the Squats, they hold on, perhaps because they were in the Galactic Core. And so they have a lot of things. They have a lot of things like these really weird tech. Again, it's kind of like comic relief because back in the day, this is just what the Squats were about. But they have like trains, like these land trains, and it looks like it looks like a giant child's toy on the battlefield. But it, obviously, because it's 40K, it's then covered in giant guns and stuff like that. But it's a trackless train, kind of scooting across the battlefield. But you know, they have other things like I believe the Leviathan, which is this kind of giant tank, this giant imperial. I think that the Imperials also call it the Imperialis Capital, or that's a variant of it. But yeah, these just giant tracked vehicles, which kind of rival the role of Titans in the Imperial military. The Squats have these, and they have some autonomy in the same way that the Adeptus Mechanicus has autonomy from the Imperium. Remember, when you look at an Aquila, you're looking at both the Imperium of Mankind, but also the Martian. I think it's called the Martian Confederation at one point. I could be wrong. I'm kind of riffing off of my own memory right now, so forgive me if that's wrong. But the Adeptus Mechanicus is a separate entity within kind of like the umbrella of Mankind. Interestingly, the Squats, you know, have that autonomy, but they also don't really have a relationship with the Emperor. I'm interested to see. Well, here, let me stay on track. So that's that. The Squats are this technologically advanced subsect of humans, and they are excused from their mutation, probably for a combination of the fact that they provide a lot of materials, mining, right? They're dwarves, but also tech, I guess also dwarves, to the Imperium, which the Imperium kind of really needs in its wars against everybody. And then they die. How do they die? We don't actually really know. A couple intrepid authors took, especially Jervis Johnson, who talks about it in Citadel Journal, a kind of early version or an offshoot of White Dwarf, you know, kind of try to explain what happened. And basically, in a nutshell, what happened to the Squats is they were ultimately betrayed. Their homeworlds were basically used as, very much like Octarius, were used as a lure for Tyranids, who came in after another war, I believe, against Chaos. The Tyranids were basically allowed to come in and eat their planets. And then that's it. Like, and the stragglers were kind of hunted down and any technology was kind of was then recovered that could be. And then we lose track of the Squats in a major way. You get little stories here and there. But generally speaking, you know, I think the biggest reappearance of the Squats were in like a fan fiction that became massively popular in like 2005 called The Rise of Tau. You can still find it on the internet and a lot of people really like it, but it's very much like the Dornian heresy. Like the authors of these two stories like did so much fan service by writing these things that it kind of elevated them to the point of celebrity. Good stuff if you ever have a couple hours to go down a Google search. But yeah, basically the Squats are gone. And this is done with very little fanfare, but you can tell that a lot of people really loved them because you, in Battlefleet Gothic, which is probably the best game that Games Workshop ever developed. And definitely the most lore intriguing. Now very much like Forge World with their Imperial Armor books, These are for like the A and S tier. I like Sanakht has infected my intelligence. By now, I now regard everything in these A, S, B, you know, tiers of elitism, I guess, or capability. The S tier gamer was involved with Forge World. Now, that's both because it was almost prohibitively expensive, especially back in the day. Like the prices of a Forge World thing where it was like 2 to 3 4 times more than you would pay for Warhammer, and Warhammer has always been expensive. But it was also like it was done with resin instead of plastic or pewter, kind of, you know, metal. It was done with resin, and with resin you had to be like, you almost needed adult supervision in order to handle it. You know, first you'd have to dip it in soap, and then you'd have to scrub it, and then you'd have to score it with a file, and then you'd have to, you know, if there were air pockets and everything, you'd have to fill those in with a special type of super glue. And this is all kind of before this is before everything was so readily available in terms of research and design. So you had to almost be like an alchemist. And if somebody threw like a Forge World piece on the tabletop, you kind of like felt like, oh man, I'm going to lose because this guy takes this way, 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 way seriously. And Battlefleet Gothic was the same thing. Battlefleet Gothic, which takes place, the reason for why it's named that is it takes place during the Gothic War, which is the 12th Crusade of Abaddon. Failbaddon is something that I take umbrage with. I find Abaddon to be one of the coolest characters in Warhammer 40K, and it really irks me that the memes have taken him apart. The guy is operating on a level that is so beyond even the Primarchs. Anyway, Abaddon is in his 12th crusade, and that is what the Gothic War is. If you want to like really like understand how the Imperium works, you can get these books for free online these days, you know, PDFs and stuff like that. But the Gothic War really is a window into that hardcore grimdark universe that existed 20 years ago and lasted up until like, it's not that long ago, but lasted really until like 5 years ago. That's where we start getting like, you know, the Primaris are a perfect example, much more clean, you know, much more of that heroic type. You know, no one is going to say that Gilliman is not the hero that we deserve, the Captain America of Warhammer 40,000. But it's just different back then. And I recommend everybody going into it. But in Battlefleet Gothic, we get the reemergence of what could be the Squats in the form of the Demiurge. And the Demiurge are, first of all, remember I said that there was a lot more cross-pollination between companies. At the time, Relic, a game company that made Dawn of War and a game called Homeworld, very much... was populated by hardcore nerds that had direct ties to Games Workshop, and so you can see a lot of things are like borrowed here and there, little Easter eggs, things like that. And the Demiurge start off as this race of miners. They're never seen outside of their ships. They heavily rely on automated drones. Which can be formatted and configured to do a variety of different things on the tabletop. The player could decide what they were shooting at you, either fighter craft, bomber craft, or assault craft, which were, you know, assault craft were and remain, if you play Battlefleet Gothic, definitely the best type of ordnance to toss at somebody. But they were miners, and they stayed in the dense asteroid belts, mining constantly. Here and there, you know, there's a game called Inquisitor, and then an iteration of Necromunda that talked about, every now and again you hear about like a Demiurge prospector device or a Demiurge cutting tool, and whoever is handling it, it's the best. It's the best technology that you can get a hold of. And it really kind of it gets a lot of Jacaro vibes. And if you the Jacaro are this kind of nomadic simian species that are known for making digital technology. Have you ever seen digi weapons? I would assume 100% of the time they are made by Jacaro, but they're aliens. And the Demiurge. And the Demiurge are kind of in that classification. And then a crazy thing happens in that with the release of the Tau and the release of more Battlefleet Gothic lore on the Tau in order to release a fleet for them. Again, some of the best Tau lore that you can get your hands on. The Demiurge in the form of the Suryatak and Therm Brotherhoods they don't join. They make a non-aggression or trade relationship with the Tau. Now, why is that interesting? Because, and I know I've said this before, but the Tau don't force everybody to join them. That would be both A, impossible, and B, it would the whole system would kind of fall apart. It's probably different when it comes to humanity, because I like to say that from the perspective of the Tau, humanity needs to be conquered for the Tau's own defense. So very much like, Alexander the Great riding out from Greece to conquer the world in order to defend Greece. If you don't stop the Imperium, eventually they're going to come and they're going to stop you. So it's a little bit of a different relationship. But the Demiurge and several other species just have these trade agreements. And first and foremost, the Demiurge are said to have this hatred for greenskins, probably because they live in the same environments, the same ecosystems. The orcs don't spend that much time on planets by comparison to the amount of time that they spend in space. By the nature of their... going to butcher this, but they're WAH fleets. By the very nature of them, they spend time getting to new worlds in order to keep like the momentum going. So orcs spend a lot of time in space, and orcs mine asteroids for the same reasons anybody else does, but then they also turn them into ships in the form of these rock craft. Rocks are the preferred ship of the orcs, because they can then use them to invade planets, and they cause a lot of havoc on the way down. Very orky. But also going back to that relationship to, okay, well, squats are dwarves. Dwarves hate orcs. Demiurge hate orcs. Well, the Demiurge must be squats. But then an interesting thing happens in that as they start showing up in Tau lore, they're very distinctly not squats. And the reason for this is that, firstly, they're described as these, robot beings. They have these suits that they never come out of. They never leave their ships. And if they do, they're these autonomy. Either the drones are automated, or there's a Demiurge inside of it. Nobody knows what it looks like. As that relationship grows, the Therm and Suryatak give this ion technology, and the Tau refer to them as Bentusan. Now, Bentusan in Tausia means wise or gifted unknown being. Sin, so the word Gwe means being, but Sin, where there are two species that have this title, the Varsinda, which is the Eldar, or excuse me, which is the Tau word for the Dark Eldar, or Drukhari, and the Bentusan, which is their term for the Demiurge. The word Sin has this dual connotation of both stranger and being, and when the Bentusan are given this moniker, I immediately perked up, because I'm a huge Relic fan and I loved the game Homeworld. But the Bentusi are the species that in this game, it's an awesome it's a fleet battle game. They give ion technology to the protagonists, and they are also unknown. They never leave their ships, and they're very much they're trade ships. Anyway, they're basically the same race. This blew my mind because eventually Relic came out with artwork from the game, and the Bentusan look like these giant... they look like a, somewhere between like a squid, an elephant, and an octopus. And I'd never seen anything so alien like that. And Warhammer 40K tends to stick to bipedal stuff. And so the idea that the Demiurge could be these octopus people, it just stuck with me forever. But as authorship continued, and the Demiurge really came into their own as an alien race, there was a kind of a conflict with Black Library in that they didn't know where to describe them. And so here and there, in Empire of Lies, for example, I believe that they are just called the Squat Demiurge by Phil Kelly. But then they're also called the Shale-Skinned Demiurge in one of the 30K books, which establishes the Demiurge as being around all the time. The Night Lords, I believe, purged them in one star system before the Heresy starts. And it's intriguing, you know. But the Demiurge are very much established as an alien species, and so very much not like the squat roots of old. But here we are now, right? The Leagues of Votan are coming out, and the community has responded with like, "Well, hold up! Like, are the Demiurge going to get folded into? Going to be like shoved into this vehicle called the Leagues of Votan? Maybe the Demiurge are an aspect of the League, or one of the, you know, a league sounds like a collection of people or organizations. Maybe that's what's happening. And if they do so, and I'm not, and again, not an authority on this, but if I look back, you know, and I look at Gothic, Battlefleet Gothic magazine, and I look at the 30K books that come out, I would be really worried that the Demiurge lose all of their alien aspects. And I'm comforted in the snippets of lore that we've been getting from the Leagues of Votan, in that the Votan openly trade with the Demiurge. And that they are often that very much like everybody else, like the Demiurge technology, especially mining technology, is something that is it's covetous, it's valuable. And very recently, at the time of this recording, about a week, less than a week ago, a couple days ago, there are these details that have come out about the Leagues of Votan being kind of directly at odds with the Imperium of Mankind, because a Votan, Votan, I don't know what it's going to end up being called, V-O-T-A-N-N. What that is a supercomputer. It's described as a cogitator. Cogitator is just a 40K term for computer. But they say that these supercogitators are gaining intelligence, right? Which flies in the face of that earlier, the mini war in heaven that I was talking about. In that artificial intelligence was outlawed. Now I'm not sure where they're going to go with that, but if the leagues are the spiritual successors to the squats, then that would mean that perhaps we're going to learn a little bit more about that war, where the Men of Iron, which were super sentient computers, perhaps an offshoot of them, went with the leagues, or at least let's call them the squats, went with the squats, and over time slowly like pulled them away from relationships with the rising Imperium and the Adeptus Mechanicus for its own safety. I think that could be a really interesting narrative hook, even more so if we think about if they keep the Leagues of Votan in the galactic core. Now remember, the galactic core is that place with the higher planet, higher gravity worlds and things like that. That's why the squats end up becoming, you know, short. If that's the case, if they stayed in the galactic core, which is known in 8th edition and prior to being a place of extreme warp storms, but more importantly, gravitational tides that can, you know, that can pull you off course and crush you. If you look at a modern map of the Warhammer 40K galaxy, it is a giant. The Cicatrix Maledictum has created a giant splotch at the center of the galaxy. Now, this could have just been the artist like not knowing what to do with the core, but it could also be a little bit of that higher long-term planning, which I'm hoping it is, that it would mean that these leagues that have perhaps been hiding in the core in order to avoid direct conflict with humanity, which is adverse to their artificial intelligences, they are now homeless. They've been shoved out of their natural territories, very much like, I guess, the craft world Eldar, and they are now out and about in the galaxy. I do hope for this, and the reason why I hope for it is here's what I don't want. I don't want the Leagues of Votan to just be, oh, they were there the whole time. This is a thing that happens a lot with lore, especially with the Centurion armor from the Space Marines. We've never heard, you know, it's not the baby on board Death Knight. It's just a larger suit that if you're in a suit of power armor, you can get into. I'm not a fan of the design, but I'm even less so a fan of the fact that it's just been around forever and it was recovered. I don't think you ever really see it in 30K. It's just awkward. It's awkward when that happens. The Tau, but if you do it like in moderation, then like the Tau, for example, come onto the scene really in terms of the Warhammer 40K universe 200 to 250 years ago, officially, if you look at the timeline. And that's manageable. The Necrons themselves only come onto the scene in terms of like the comprehension of the Imperium, like a few hundred years ago with the their initial awakening on Angelus, also called Gorka Morka. But then you also get like the fact that the Dark Eldar have only very recently been interacting in any kind of like official capacity. If you read the Path of the Eldar books, like the Eldar themselves are not clear as to who the Dark Eldar are. Whereas a lot of people think that like Kamora like collapsed a long time ago, except, you know, it's still going on. So the power of ignorance in Warhammer 40,000, I think, is its biggest tool. And I would much rather have the Votan be coming out into this new galaxy. Like, yes, they're going to be kind of closer to the Dark Age of Technology humans. They clearly, with this lore release, they have some kind of closer relationship with artificial intelligence, regardless of whatever those cogitators end up being, even if it's people plugged into a wall, which kind of the artwork shows. In the descriptions, it's like these things are getting more eccentric. So eccentricity is often a sign of sentience or sapience. I think that we need something to have come out of the Cicatrix Maledictum. The Eye of Terror collapsing in on itself and then expanding outward and spreading the Cicatrix to cut the entire galaxy in half and turning one half of the galaxy into, kind of like this rolling hellscape, and then the other half of the galaxy for some reason is on the better side, you know, with Gilliman coming back and everything. Not much has happened. Like Abaddon, who again I finished praising, did this masterful stroke at Cadia and then doesn't really have any follow-up. Like me personally, I don't know what Nakmund represents. I don't see how Nakmund is part of his big overall plan, and it feels like a lot of stuff right now in that overarching narrative that I keep bringing up feels like it's stalled. It feels like everybody's doing what they do. The Tower expanding, the Tyranids are eating, the Necrons are necroning. it just feels like, what, you know, we had this giant warp storm, not even a warp storm, a tear in the fabric of space-time split the galaxy in half, and everything seems kind of just like, you know, any other Tuesday. It would be nice if the Leagues of Votan, with all of this history of what the squats were, hopefully with the divergence from what the Demiurge are, I hope that this is an opportunity to really highlight how the Cicatrix Maledictum is upsetting the, or has upset the balance. And I'm excited to see what they've got. I mean, and I say this probably like any other like any other Tau enthusiast, I look at the Demiurge as a chance for new bits for my conversion library. Thank you so much for listening today. We're going to get back to a more regular schedule of hopefully once a week on Saturdays, and again we'll be opening it up for a couple more subject matters in overall Warhammer 40,000. Thank you again for listening. For those of you who are here, thank you for coming, and it's a pleasure to see you all again. I guess the last thing I'll leave off with is just the age-old reminder that this is a totally unaffiliated podcast. It has nothing to do with anything official in regards to Games Workshop. It's just us. Calm Surge signing out, and see you next week. Good hunting.